what we used to keep calling the demographic dividend really seems to be turning into a demographic nightmare.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. If you go to college in a low or a middle-income country, how does it help you? And what do you get from the experience? Two questions that would seem to have obvious answers. But as Jishnu Das of Georgetown has pointed out in a recent article, the answers may be more complicated than they seem, and some of the research that could provide those answers, well, it doesn't even exist yet. He joins me now. Jishnu, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
I am as well. Let's start with some good news. Are more young adults in low and middle income countries attending college?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there are multiple ways to see this. One simple way to do it is just to go to the World Bank data. Mm-hmm. If you look at tertiary school enrollment around the world, in 2000, it used to be 19% in gross terms, and now it's 42%. Now, you might think that's mostly coming from high-income countries, but nope. If you look at low- and middle-income countries, the number is 37% right now. Abhijit Singh and Alan Sanchez did this great paper called Accessing Higher Education in Developing Countries, where they looked at what's called the Young Lives data, which tracks children over time. And they showed that in India, Peru, Vietnam, 40% of this younger cohort that was born around the new century are now in colleges, right? And that's not urban kids. This is kids who are in villages, in small towns. I mean, these are representative samples that we are thinking about. I have a personal story, Tim. In Pakistan, we have this long panel that started tracking kids who were between 5 and 15 in 2003. So then in 2018, we went back to track them. So we went to a household, we knock on the door, somebody opens the door, and I'm like, oh, we've been coming here for a long time, since 2003, we're looking for this person. Do you know where she is? Can we talk to her? And she's like, she's not home right now. And I was like, oh, where is she? She's at college. This is a rural village in the middle of Pakistan. And I was like, huh, what's going on? And it really took off from there. This phenomenal change in the landscape on how many people are going to college.
And these colleges exist because these are millions of young lives that are different now to a generation ago. There are the colleges for them to go to.
Again, the numbers are just completely insane. It's shocking. Recently, I was in Uttar Pradesh, which is a state in India. And about 15 years back, they had 40 nurse training colleges. Today, they have 780. And then you look at the data for India, and it turns out between 2003 and at least 2016, I'm not sure after 2016, India was setting up a college every 8 hours.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. It's completely nuts. So the growth of the higher education sector, at least in India, Pakistan, I mean, countries I know well, but I suspect in around the world, really, whether it's vocational training such as nurses or whether it's generalized training, it's just been phenomenal.
And in high-income countries, we've always talked about and measured the college premium in earnings, that if you go to further education, you can expect to earn more for the rest of your life. Does that exist in low-middle-income countries?
Absolutely. So the work on this that I think is really important is what Claudio Montenegro and Harry Petrinos did out of the World Bank.
Uh-huh.
So they made these estimates of returns to schooling, saying, what's your wage increase if you're a certain number of years of schooling? And we all know the problems with causality on that, but all the stuff shows it's not a bad measure. It's not a bad approximation. What they show is that over time, the returns to going to school have actually come down.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at South Asia, for example, it's not clear that you get any returns to your schooling until you make it to college.
Aha, right.
And actually, in sub-Saharan Africa, the returns to college are 22%, but the returns to school are in the range of 10% or 8%. So sub-Saharan Africa is one of the few places where there's still returns to not going to college, even if you don't go to college. Everywhere else, it's looking like if you don't go to college, you don't see those wage returns. You can be more subtle about it. You can't make it to college unless you've gone through school. But if you stop before going to college, unclear, really unclear.
Now, the quantity has increased dramatically. What do we know about the quality of that education?
Very little.
Ooh.
I think partly because it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
When you reach college, you suddenly do a lot of different things. So we don't have a great sense of, among all these different things that you do, how much more are you learning? But my guess is that's going to be a subtlety on a big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And the big picture doesn't look good. We test these kids that we went back 15 years later, right? They're about an average age of 25. Essentially, what we find is that test scores when they were 15 are the same or not very different from when they're 25 or 22 and they've gone to college. This is saying, can you read a paragraph? This is saying, can you divide two numbers? And those things haven't improved. The work that has done this more systematically is a paper by Prashant Loyalka and a lot of other people in a journal called Human Nature, Human Behavior. They look at skill levels and gains in university STEM education in China, India, Russia, and the United States. In the US, you get reasonable gains. In all of these other places, even in the elite colleges, the gains are not that big.
What does this tell us about who's actually going to college, perhaps? Because we always think of further education as this engine of social mobility, a meritocracy where the brightest kids get the chance to excel. Do we know if the right kids are ending up at college?
Yeah, you packed a lot into that statement, and there were two parts. So first of all, I find it interesting that people think that education is an equalizer.
Yeah.
Because if you think even of our basic model, we say that people who are more able should get more education. But of course, that's going to amplify existing inequalities, right? So in all our models, education's an amplifier of inequality. The reason we're okay with that is we say, that's kind of good inequality because it's inequality across persons and not inequality across peoples, right? So, you know, we're like, okay, you know, that kid was really smart, went to college, earned more, good for him. But we get really trouble when we say, hey, that kid who's going to college is only from one ethnicity or one race or one household background. So I think the way to think about it is, are our systems meritocratic? If so, does meritocracy still privilege only one race, right? Have we replaced inequality through fiat or aristocracy by inequality through meritocracy?
Mm-hmm.
These kids we followed, we have their test scores when they were 12 years old. And a precise question you can ask is, are the kids who are making it into college, do they have higher test scores? And is it that low test score kids don't make it in? Or does your family background still matter once I've looked at your test scores? So we show that in five countries, which is India, Pakistan, Peru, Vietnam, Ethiopia. So it's Pakistan and the four Young Lives countries. It's true that kids who had higher test scores are more likely to make it into college. But the really troubling part, the kid from a poor household who was in the top 1% of their class when they were 12 has exactly the same number of years of completed schooling as the kid from a high-income household who was in the bottom 1% of their class. And that's true in every one of these countries. In Peru, it's much worse. Even the kids who were in the top 1% of their class, if they came from a poor background, they're going to have fewer years of education. Everybody from a high-income background is making it in. Nobody from a low-income background is making it in. Not a selection system, some kind of combination of a bit of selection, but a whole degree of unfairness.
So, Jishnu, we have a lot to talk about. What we know, what we don't know about what's going on, and what policies might improve these outcomes. Let's go back to these returns to education. I would imagine that a huge motivator for the expansion of further education is that parents want their kids to get a really good job. What are they imagining as a good job, that dream job that makes young people in low and middle income countries commit to college?
I think in at least the context that I'm aware of, so I know India fairly well, I know Pakistan fairly well. There's wonderful work from Ghana by Esther Duflo, Michael Kramer, Pascaline Tupa, and others. In each of these cases, the way that people think about good jobs is that it's a job in the public sector.
Right, yeah.
So a job in the public sector gives you much higher wages, and it gives you a pension, and it gives you a lifetime job. Wage differences can be really large. We find, for example, among teachers, it's as high as 5 times as high. So that's your really good job. Now, do people get those jobs?
That is the question. So if you've got this massive expansion of tertiary education, I don't suppose you've got the massive expansion of the public sector at the same time.
This is one of those places where things start getting murky.
Yeah.
The reason things start getting murky is anytime you're looking at where people are in jobs, it's starlight, right? You're looking at some star that started a while back and you're seeing it now. I think what we can say that I think is a reasonable story is until the 2000s, we actually find that among people who had gone to college in household surveys, which is a small fraction at that time, and are employed, a large number are in the public sector. Take 100 people who have gone to college and look at them when they're employed and look at where they're employed. Among the cohorts that household surveys from 2000, that group were mostly a large number of them actually had public sector jobs. And a big fraction of that is just teachers.
Yeah.
So even in UK and the US, these are large numbers. What's happened since? In our cohort, so these are kids now 22 to 32, we have 2,500 men. Female labor force participation is really low, so men are good to look at. 50 of them have a formal sector job, and 30 out of those are in the army and police. It mostly gig economy work, little bit of agriculture, but no, these good jobs that I call, or my friend Tahir Andrabi calls, you know, achieving escape velocity, not yet. Definitely not by the time we're looking at them. The question that we don't know, could it be if we come back in 8 years, a lot more of them have these jobs? Because the last year to apply may be when you're 32, maybe that's the part we're not sure about.
And so in the getting of these escape velocity jobs, because there seems to be such huge competition from them now for people who have been to college, is it the case then that it's social networks, those other skills that are helping them to get their jobs, family connections?
You know, going back, I was just rereading Mark Granovetter's amazing work in 1974, Getting a Job, where the whole point was in the US, most jobs, you work through connections, contacts, that kind of stuff, right? So then it's picked up again in France, Pierre Bourdieu. I mean, the whole point of social capital, your habitus, the cultural capital is this precisely you're unemployed, you've gone to college. And now if you have this cultural capital, you have your family, you have your contact, you get to do a bunch of things. The book that I've been reading, which is very useful and very important, it's called Degrees Without Freedom, and it's by Craig Jeffrey, Patricia Jeffrey, and Roger Jeffrey. So they study two villages in India, looking at these kids from different caste groups who have gone to college. They're not finding these jobs. And what are they doing? And they show there are multiple strategies. So some of them are moving into politics. Some of them are trying to migrate to the city. Some of them are worldly in the sense that they realize that when they're trying to get a public sector job, there are 10,000 applicants for each job. And you need to have those contacts, need to figure out how this works. So it's really interesting. All these strategies, do we have a very clear sense of how that 10-year period from 20 to 32 works out? And what happens after? No, we don't.
That other question we've left hanging was that amazing statistic about high achievers from poor families. Why don't more poor kids go to college? What is happening between that time that they are tested and we find out that they're exceptional and that time where they just don't push on to further education?
That's a million-dollar question, not only because our societies are now struggling with the level of inequality that we've produced. But also, if you just think in terms of lost potential, we are taking the most brilliant people in our countries, and they don't have the opportunities to move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
The short answer is, I don't know. We clearly need a whole set of experiments. I think, Tim, it might be worthwhile going back and saying, why are we interested in that group? Because that itself is this big tension inherent in the way we interact with society, but also misunderstood. So all the emphasis right now has been on, hey, can we make children learn more when they're in primary school? But I still remember talking to bureaucrats, talking to politicians, and they were like, people hold us accountable. They think that how they do in school is kind of on them. And at least that narrative's been constructed. Frankly, I have never, and I've interviewed hundreds of families, I've never had a family tell me, and it's sad, that, hey, my kid's not doing well in school. It's the school's fault. It's always, oh, but the kid's not good at studying. So somehow that narrative's been created. So the politicians will tell you, what they hold me responsible for is they did everything right and they didn't get a job. Or my kid did so well in school and then didn't find a place in college. That's what they're holding me responsible for. But now look at the inversion. We're saying, no, we should care about high-achieving kids who are not making it further, which is a very different emphasis from we should care about low-achieving kids who are not becoming high-achieving.
Yeah.
So it requires a shift in focus and an ethical discussion of we need to care about both. Why are they not making it? You know, there's a usual list of things you can say. Maybe the family is credit constrained and are not able to borrow money for college. Maybe they're needed for work at home. Maybe their aspirations are different. Maybe the parents don't realize that their kids are actually really smart and would make it forward. I don't think we have a good answer, to tell you the truth, at the moment. We do need to have a series of work and emphasis on those kids if we are to think about how our societies can do better.
Yes, because I guess unless you know exactly what is going on there, it's useless to try and put policies in place to try and fix that problem if you don't know what it is yet.
Yep. There's this two-way story, right? So somebody will tell you, hey, why are you fixing on those guys when half the people can't even read a sentence?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the right answer is, let's try and do some work with those guys to see how expensive it is to get them into college, to get them there and see what jobs they get. Because it might well be that the returns are pretty high at that stage. And there's wonderful work that Imran Rasool, Oriana Bandiera, and others did in Uganda, showing that even vocational training of like $500 worth, when these kids were 15 or so, very disadvantaged kids, massively increased their wages.
Mm-hmm.
And now as an economist, you sit back and say, whoa, that's very different from what people think in the US, where people think that's too late. We need to go back and start thinking pretty hard about at least generating some evidence on what's happening down the pipeline among high-achieving kids who are not making it further.
Yes, I remember talking to Imran about that a couple of years ago. It is very exciting work. And it contrasts very much with what you were saying about what we know about the quality of education that's happening in these colleges in some places. Now, how are these colleges actually working at the moment then? Are they a kind of a filter? You can't apply for the job unless you've been through this college experience, even if it doesn't do much for you. Is it a sort of a signal? You're the sort of person who's ambitious enough to go to college, so therefore you might be worth employing. Are these narratives true?
I think the most fascinating paper I've read is Sheetal Shekri's paper. She's at the University of Virginia, and she looks at kids in India. So the one thing in India is you got to be really fair about who's going into college, otherwise you're going to revolt. So there's an exam, there's a cutoff, you go into college, depending on where that cutoff is, right? That cutoff, by the way, is usually about 99% or 100% for the top colleges, but let's leave that aside, right?
Yes.
Kids who are on the right of the cutoff, so who made it into these colleges, much higher wages. Not higher test scores, not a lot better on learning. So she thinks what's going on is you get a bunch of social networks when you make it into these colleges, into these elite colleges. And that's an important part of going to college. But absolutely, the second part, as education's gone up, so have the minimal qualifications. So now for a lot of public sector jobs, including in some cases, being a gardener requires a college degree. So you can't even apply for these jobs unless you have a college degree. It's become a necessary part of life for a whole host of jobs that you need to apply to.
Again, this is a huge policy challenge, isn't it? To be able to fix this if we decide that this is not the optimal way that further education should function. Well, how do we change the education?
Yep. I have no clue. You know, seriously, right? On the one hand, people are making these decisions. So you could say, hey, what's really screwed up here is people don't know that they're making the wrong decisions. Maybe like in Ghana, they're totally overestimating the chances that they'll get a public sector job.
Yeah.
And then you could say, oh, that's worth fixing. But otherwise, there is an understandable reluctance, I think, among economists to say, if people are making those decisions, it's not very clear. There are 10,000 things that they could be learning in college that we haven't measured properly or that we don't know about. Should we intrude? And it's a tough question. I don't think we know the right answer. Because on the one hand, if you're saying, hey, low-income kids are not making it in, clearly the returns are in college and we should promote them. On the other hand, the kids are not learning anything on the metrics we usually think about. That's where the confusion is. I don't know, Tim, right, what's the right way to think about this or the right way to move forward.
Is one of the ways to think about it, to start putting pressure on this notion that the good job is the government job, because then maybe more good students would go and learn professions, learn business.
At some level, the good job is the government job.
Yeah.
You're looking at lifetime incomes that are 5 to 10 times higher than anything else you're going to get. I think the social contract in a lot of these countries are, if you make it into a government job, we'll support you for life. And I think that's going to be very hard to break. People are trying other things. It's just, there's a huge problem with the availability of jobs in these countries. And we have to look at the labor market fairly clearly. And this is what a lot of people are talking about. That structural transformation where suddenly all these industrial jobs come in, maybe it ain't happening. So what are we going to do next? From a private angle, it seems at this point that it makes a lot of sense for a lot of people to be trying to go to college and try to get that public sector job, even though they probably won't succeed.
There is so much academic work in low and middle income countries, into education, research into the value of education, what is a good education, how do we improve education? Why is it that in this conversation, you have read so much, so broadly and so deeply in this, but yet we are so often saying we don't quite know what's going on here? Why are we missing something?
My guess is we never set up very carefully what I call cradle to labor market panels. We have a lot of cross-sectional data. We have panels at various times. We have labor force surveys. We have all of this kind of stuff. We have very little that tracks people over time and different cohorts. So we don't know these cohort experiences in a way that we should. We end up missing the fact that these cohort experiences tell a story. Raj Chetty's really demonstrated the importance of understanding these cohort experiences in the US. And I think once we start doing that, we'll start really picking up what's going on in that school-to-work pipeline in low-income countries around the world.
If you're advising a young researcher, I imagine you probably do, who is interested in these type of questions, what sort of research would you advise them to do? What sort of questions are the most interesting ones to be asking?
I was once told, and that's super relevant even today, which is there are papers that are interesting, that's academia, there are papers that are important, that's policy, and there are papers that are interesting and important, and that's gold, right?
Yes.
The question is, how do you get interesting and important in 5 years? I think what we're missing and what I would start thinking about very hard is picking up kids as they enter high school and tracking them through at least the first 5 years of post-school and then passing that off. What's going to happen is if they go to college, you've still got that 4 years there. And then you've got this period from like 22 to 32 where it just flux. Mm-hmm. I want to see what happens to these kids once they settle. But we've got this big 22 to 32, 10-year ages where it's all flux. I think the challenge I would set forth is how do we get your high school experience, see you through the flux, and understand what happens to you as you settle. That's, I think, the big, big payoff at this point is setting up those kinds of studies.
These are enormously consequential questions, both for individuals who want to make the best of their lives, but also for economies as a whole. What are the consequences if we do not get the policy relevant answers and potentially then get the policies wrong about this?
I think people are getting really, really angry about the fact that they did everything right and they didn't get a job. I think that anger is palpable. We don't have a lot of time to fix it. That's going to be the key story, and everybody's worried about it. Talk to politicians. The first thing on their lips is not, we got to improve primary schooling. It's, these kids who have made it through are not getting a job. What we used to keep calling the demographic dividend, this big cohort of young people, it really seems to be turning into a demographic nightmare. That's the biggest issue that we face as societies today.
Jishnu Das, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thanks so much, Tim. That was a pleasure.
If you're looking for Jishnu's article that inspired our conversation today, it's on LinkedIn, and it's called The Great College Conundrum, a coming-of-age story. We referenced a lot of research, far too much for me to list here, but he has referenced it all at the end of his article. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.